It's interesting for me to look at this array of materials because they reflect strategies for raising children, which is my research interest, the whole question of how one generation figures out what it wants the next generation to do and be and learn. And the idea of a guarded education, structured as it was, closed away from the outside world so that that what goes in can be controlled, is so reflected in this library, so reflected in the notes that Newbold Trotter took from Daniel Smith, exactly what he said. There is an exact reflection of what the older generation hoped the next generation would acquire. Those strategies are the basis of my kind of research interests. But certainly people in the 1830s, not just Friends, but many other people, were concerned that moral and virtue and conscience all be incorporated into a school curriculum. What Quakers were doing, Orthodox Friends in the 1830s when they started the school, was trying to make sure not only that young Friends became true Quakers, reading from the scriptures, practicing ethics, and so on, but also to make sure that they didn't become Hicksites, which in some ways was worse from their point of view. That is to say, the Orthodox Friends worried that the Hicksites had strayed away from a strictly focused Quaker way of living, and part of Haverford's job was to protect them from it. In this business of strategies for raising children and showing them through curriculum and reading who they should be, one aspect that's particularly interesting is the notion that Quakers should be anti-slavery. The picking up of the Clarkson novel, the French piece on the causes of slavery, these are reflections of a rising tide among a certain narrow stream of Quakers that connected slavery with Quaker philanthropy. And in some ways, one could argue that slavery became the maypole around which a certain set of Quakers wound themselves as their standard for that particular piece of religious reality in the 19th century. Not every Quaker hooked onto this, but some of the energy for educating people was wrapped around the idea of the immorality of slavery and the antithesis of the sort of morality that was the standard of the curriculum. Another interesting aspect about the strategy for educating children or for bringing young people into a community and making that community remain strong is the degree to which the elders had control over these young people in a way that we don't today. Their elders controlled what they read and how much time they had to themselves and where they slept and when they went off campus and how far they went off campus and where they went when they went off campus. And we don't have any of that kind of control today. This very controlled library reminds me how circumscribed a student's experience was in 1835 to 1850 versus the seemingly wide open and infinite world that people experience now while we're trying to shape them into something or encourage them in some direction. It's just a very different environment, a very different set of experiences for students, and this library, with its careful control, is such a perfect reflection of that. By the 1880s, Bryn Mawr had opened, and Bryn Mawr from the beginning had a rich and deep library. And so the Haverford Library, with its very carefully narrowed limits, began to look very narrow. The absence of classical literature, the absence of history. It's really a very limited array of materials. And so when I do research on how Generation 1 tries to transmit its values to Generation 2, I look for what's not there as well as what's there. And the richness of this library is that you can see the empty spaces. You can see that literature isn't there. You can see that even Quaker fiction isn't there. So I find this a fascinating array of materials to look through the books at the ways Haverford community tried to create a protected environment in which students would learn.